You are listening to episode 19 of season 7 of the GNU World Order. Hi everyone, this is Klaatu, and this is the GNU World Order. This is my little show where I talk about GNU and Linux and Unix and things like that, technical stuff. This episode is one away from the big action-packed season finale, so this is an important occasion. After this, of course, I do my traditional sabbatical, where I go off to a foreign country and have various adventures and, you know, try to rest up and write new episodes and audition my new, you know, the latest sidekick that I'm going to have. All the usual stuff. You're used to it by now. It's season 7. You know the drill. But hey, we don't have to worry about that yet. We've still got two more episodes, including this one, so let's get started with some listener feedback. First listener feedback email that I've got is from randomly picking what we'll call first. Well, lots and lots of reviews. I mean, I'm talking two, possibly three if I've forgotten one, of the latest Fat Chance Lester album, which, in case you don't know, I played some keyboards on and I mix. I don't even mix, really. I mash up and refine. I did not record this myself, and it wasn't recorded terribly recently. It's a couple of years old, so this is just stuff that I'm releasing, and you hear the music over the beginning and the end of the episode every 2 weeks, so that's kind of what we're talking about. So yeah, I released another album fairly recently called Ghost of a Chance, and if you haven't heard it yet or if you haven't checked it out, feel free to do so. It's over at Astiopod, A-E-S, like the encryption, D-I-O, like God, P-O-D, like the music player, astiopod.com/Lester. That's, as usual, I'm getting hosting donated to me, and that's where it stays, astiopod.com/Lester, and click on Ghost of a Chance, and you should be able to get the AUG version or the AAC version. If you use a device that doesn't do AUG, you can listen to it. It's free. You can share it. It's all Creative Commons. So have fun with that if you dig the spacey, trippy rock sounds of the GNU World Order. And if not, that's okay. No harm done. No hurt feelings. I'm not making any money off of it, so I'm not really affected on whether you do or don't listen. But, I mean, if you do, I'd love to hear your thoughts. Long-time listeners, or listeners from within this season anyway, will know that a guy named Raven was emailing me earlier in the show asking, I think, about distribution recommendations. And that's always a hard question, obviously. I mean, it's kind of like someone says, what distro should I run? And all you can do is sort of spout off that you've had a good experience with such and such. I put in the caveat that, but other people seem to like such and such. So it's a weird question, hard to answer, but I try to do so honestly. He ended up in Sabayon, because it turns out that's not a French word, it's an Italian dessert. But he ended up with Sabayon Linux, and he was liking it. And he actually even, I mean, like his excitement over it combined with Sound Chaser from Kernel Panic Ogcast kind of inspired me to try it myself, and I really liked it, but I eventually settled the person I was going to possibly put onto Sabayon, ended up with Fedora just because I'm more familiar with that, and from a support standpoint, it's a lot easier to support something that you really, really know. So, but Sabayon did make an impression on me, and certainly I've always been, I guess you could say, morbidly curious about Gentoo, and Sabayon comes from that, so it's all kind of interest. And Raven recently emailed me just to kind of give a status update. And he says that Sabayon has ditched their previous package management application called Entropy, which, I mean, if you ask me, you're kind of asking for trouble if you call your package management Entropy. But yeah, they called it Entropy. Now they've ditched it, and they've started a new one called Rigo, R-I-G-O, I think it is. And he says that it's a lot better. He says it takes a little bit of getting used to if you're not used to it, and I guess no one is because it's new, but it takes a little bit of getting used to, but it's a lot better. So that's kind of good to hear. And it sounds like Sabayon's really just kind of trucking along, and that's always nice to hear about a Linux distribution, that it's got a good community and that it seems to be pushing out a quality product. Another listener emailed me, his name is Sons of Man in IRC, and he asked if I knew of any application, or if I'd had any luck, rather, with cracking GPG passwords. I've not ever had to try to do that, so I have not either had luck or not had luck. It's just something I've never attempted before, which, now that he mentions it, seems crazy. Why wouldn't I have looked into that before just for fun? So he referred me actually to an application called Nasty, which sounds fun. And it's at vanhusten.com. That's vanhusden.com/nasty. And it's a really cool looking application. I have not really tested it. I just got this email when I sat down to record this show. So more on that probably next week or so. But you should check that out if you've never heard of it. It could be interesting. vanhusden.com/nasty. Have fun with that. In terms of the GPG thing, I honestly always just kind of thought, well, if you lose your passphrase, you get to revoke your key or forget your passphrase, whatever. You get to revoke your key and establish a new one. But I don't know if this guy's asking me, you know, if the word lost is a euphemism for, hey, I'm trying to crack someone's GPG key, or if he really did lose it. I don't know. Either way, I figure if you do try this application and you can't crack your own passphrase, that's probably a good thing. And last but certainly not least, I've got an email here from Mr. Work or Mr. Phone or Mr. Jackson, and it contains a PNG of a QR code scanner result on his Android phone. So it does, this is from earlier episodes when I was wondering what happens when you scan a QR code. Well, apparently, whatever this application is on the Android phone, maybe it's the default, I don't know, I don't remember, it pops up what you've scanned and what URL that resolves to. And obviously, if it's some completely unfamiliar and suspicious-looking URL, then you could skip over that. If you think it looks okay, then you can choose what to do with that URL, what application to open it in, and so on. Well, I forgot to mention that Christian from from Europe, rather, emailed me and told me that the GNU.org site had Emacs mugs on sale. So these Emacs mugs are ceramic mugs, you know, coffee mugs and such, and they have Emacs keybinding, like a cheat sheet, all around the mug. So, and of course it's got a big GNU Emacs logo on it, you know, so you can kind of be proud of your Emacs usage around the office, I guess. I already have a mug, so I'm not going to get one, but I thought it was kind of a cool thing, and perhaps not coincidentally, of course, Emacs 24 has recently been released, specifically on June 10th of this year, so about a month ago now. One of the features of the new Emacs 24, actually I think it's 24.1 technically is what they released as stable, but one of the new features is a new packaging system and a corresponding interface to that. So you hit meta X and you type in list-packages, or obviously you could, that's list as in list them, not Lisp as in the programming language, list-packages, and obviously you could assign that to any key binding that you chose if it was something that you wanted to use frequently. And what it does is it lists all of the packages that are found on this GNU.org repository that is maintained by the Emacs developers, and you can pick and choose from what's installed or what you would like to install and try out. And obviously it would, just like any package manager would, manage the updates and different things like that for you, I guess. I haven't actually used it long enough at this point to have experienced an update on any of the packages that I have. But I did try it. I tried the Emacs package manager on 23, because I'm actually not running Emacs 24 still, but I did install it on one of my 23 Emacs installs, Emacs 23.3 or whatever it is, and gave it a quick go. It feels, I would say, very much like Aptitude, because it's a little bit of an interactive feel that, at least for me, Yum doesn't really have, or ports, or Slack builds doesn't. I mean, Slack builds does if you use SBOPKG, but then that's a completely different style of interaction. It's a big interface, a GUI, you know, in Curses interface. So it's a different feel to me. So this felt a little bit like Aptitude, which actually was nice because the install that I have this on is an old G3 iBook that runs Debian without any GUI, no X. X is not even installed on it. It's really just kind of a portable Emacs machine that I take around to cafes because the battery is really, really good. But yeah, it's a neat little thing. And I sat down and, you know, I was test driving it on this little Debian iBook because I thought, well, I don't want to spoil anything that I rely on. You know, I didn't feel like I wanted to install this and start messing around with an environment that I felt very comfortable with. So I tried it as a test run on this Debian iBook, and I like it. It's fun. It's nice. And I love the idea of this package management thing because it manages things for you, but it, more importantly, I think it just gives you a look into what's available. I think, honestly, I think especially for free software where there's no money for advertising, how do you learn about new applications in an environment where they're not cramming it down your throat every 15 minutes between TV shows or they're not coming on major commercial podcasts? It pains me, by the way, to even say that there are such things. But yeah, they're not going on to these major commercial podcasts and saying, hey, you got to try this. We sponsored this show, so come to our site, enter this code, and get the free software for free. You know, it just doesn't happen. So how do you learn about free software? And I thought about how people do learn about free software. And, I mean, there's obviously different styles of finding stuff online, right? You go to a news site or some kind of, you know, some kind of bulletin board or forum or whatever they're called these days that you enjoy and look at what other people are talking about. Or you go into IRC and eavesdrop or talk and find out about new applications that way. You know, there are a lot of different ways to find applications, but it seems like you really are hunting for these things, which is fine. I'm fine with that. I would rather have to look than be told about things over and over again until my brain hurts to even think about whatever that is. You know, I don't care for advertising myself. So the fact that it's not there unless you're asking for it, I like that. I find that helpful. But when you ask for it, it should be there. It should not be hidden. And, I mean, not that I don't know, you know, of any free software that tries to hide itself, but it's nice when you fire up an app store of some sort, or as we call it, a repository, package manager, you fire that up, and there's a big list of all the applications, or in this case, all the Emacs plugins that you could possibly want to use. And I think that's really, really a good thing. That's a feature. Because even if I don't feel like letting this package manager install things for me and do whatever it wants to do, you know, uninstall, install, update, whatever. Even if I didn't want to do that, and I might not, I'm on my real machines, I really might not do that anytime soon. I'm pretty used to the way I'm doing it now, and I'm happy with my kind of knowing what version my plugins are on and stuff like that. So, you know, it might not happen, might never happen, but it might. I might like it enough to stay with it. And so if I do that, I like to have the option of saying, okay, well, list packages because I'm looking for a tool for such and such a job, or I heard about a plugin, but I can't remember the name, but if I see a list, it'd probably jog my memory, that kind of thing. I think that's very cool. I also like that it's integrated now into Emacs. Jay Lindsay actually told me, a couple of people have, we've had this conversation before in IRC, so a couple of people have mentioned like other package management solutions for Emacs before it became official in 24, actually. So they've been around. It's not a completely new concept. People have done this before. And from what I understand, the one that became official used to be one of the more popular unofficial ones. ELPA, I think, is what it was called. So they've been around. It's not a completely new and revolutionary thing. It's just that it's integrating it officially. And I do tend to just kind of like that. When a project says, okay, yes, we know that this stuff is going on, people are getting these solutions prepared for something that they feel is important. You know, they want package management in Emacs. We don't really have it. They want it. It's cropping up. Let's decide on one and kind of make it the the one that we give the stamp of approval to, and we'll help manage it and stuff like that. And it becomes fairly ubiquitous. I mean, I guess the potential problem is there that, oh my gosh, what if they chose the one that isn't as good as the other? And I'm sure there are going to be problems with any solution that you choose, but I do think it's vaguely important sometimes for a project to settle on one and kind of say, okay, this is the one that is the standard, the gold standard. Now you can, maybe not even gold, it's just the standard. You can develop alternatives, you can do whatever you want, but this is the one that we're going to support. And I think that's helpful because the new users will be able to use the standard one. We'll all have kind of a common language. We can say, okay, well, how did you install this plugin? From such and such, or did you get it from so and so? And it really narrows down the troubleshooting potential. But of course, it's done in the typical free software style. I mean, I should hope so, it being the poster child of free software, but it's done in that sort of typical free software style where, yes, there's a standard, or yes, there's something quote-unquote official, but it doesn't exclude any of the unofficial stuff. And that, once again, as we all have heard, I'm sure, each other say a million times, that's the power of free software. You've got that choice. No one ever takes that away from you. You've got flexibility. You've got total freedom. But there's still that option of saying, okay, let's get back to just the standards, to just what shipped from GNU.org, and take it from the beginning and try to troubleshoot our way out of this problem, or whatever the situation might be. So it's good, I think, that they kind of recognized the need for a package manager, although I say need with italics or something, because I'm not sure if it's a need, but it's definitely, I mean, I as I've already said in this very season, one of Linux's big progressive things that, as usual, no one's going to give it credit for, is the idea of the App Store, or the Marketplace, or whatever you want to call it, that repository idea, where you've got a central location for all these applications, and people can go to that thing, see what's available, install stuff, and it's all very neat and literally packaged and very helpful. So yeah, Emacs is kind of joining in on that, and I think that's a good thing. You should check it out if you have not tried already. You can use it on either 23 or 24, but if you do use it on 23, of course, you'll have to kind of, you have to install it manually, basically. But it's not hard to do that. You can, it's literally like maybe 8 lines of ELISP code that you put into your .emacs file. It's very, very simple. 330 actually was the one who told me that I could do it on 23, and he linked me to a page that I will include in the show notes, so you can check it out for yourself. I know what you're thinking. You're thinking, it seems a little bit early for a coffee break. To which I say to you, my friend, it is never too early for a coffee break. So go get yourself a cup of coffee, come back, and we'll finish up the show. For quite some time, I've gotten comments on Slackware. Often they're questions, sometimes they're just kind of comments, but many of them betray kind of a perception that Slackware is very, very hard to use, and it's difficult to maintain. And I think that if you say that to any Slackware user, the typical response will be something like, you're doing it wrong, or you're confused about the Slackware way. And this is very true, because Slackware seeks, I mean, if Slackware actually works very, very hard to make things easier on you, the user, by simplifying things. You'll see this all over the place in Slackware. But the weird thing about Slackware, and maybe this is related to what I was just saying about like the lack of advertisement, or maybe this is just because of the interestingly decentralized nature of Slackware, kind of the almost hands-off nature of Slackware. But it's sometimes difficult to crack that code of what exactly that Slackware way is. And I don't know that I have the consensus of the Slackware community to such a degree that I could say, here's what the Slackware way is. But I'm going to tell you here what generally speaking, I think most Slackware users kind of kind of do and have done for a long time. And obviously there are plenty of Slackware users out there that have been using Slackware a lot longer than I have. But this is where I'm at so far along this this road to finding the maximum amount of Slack. So this is sort of a mini how-to, I guess. And this actually took me a long time to figure out, too. I think coming in from knowing nothing about Slackware and not a whole lot about Unix in general, and then learning as you go, while it's a great, great path to go down, it can be a little bit not well lit sometimes. And I'm going to contrast it, for instance, to Ubuntu, where Ubuntu, again, you have to know where to look, even with Ubuntu, amazingly. You have to know the right places to go. But if you go to those places, you get a lot of hand-holding, and I mean that in the best possible way. You get led down this path of, okay, first you need to understand this, and then you need to go over here and understand that, and then you're ready to try this, and then you can keep going down this path and go here. You really do get that in a big way if you go along that path, if you kind of sign up, you know, as an Ubuntu noob. You can get a lot of guidance. Whereas on Slackware, I feel like if you crack open the Slack book, I mean, I bought the hard copy of that thing. I've got Slackware Essentials. I read it from cover to cover. I thought it was the best thing I'd ever read. It probably was. It's a great book. But you read that and you don't get that sense of, here's how I need to lead my life in order to be a Slackware user. So that's what I'm going to tell you now, is how you need to lead your life. You need to live your life such that you are a Slacker. I have 8 pillars of truth, or something grandiose like that. The 0th one would be, of course, to get Slackware. In order to be a Slackware user, to be a Slacker, to understand what it is to have Slack, you need to get Slack. You know, you need to go to slackware.com, download the ISO, and install it. And that's kind of that's just kind of what you have to do. And I'm not saying you have to do that right now, because you're certainly welcome to go read a book first. You know, there's a Slack book online, slackbook.org. You can read that. You can read Slacker Media. Both of these books will give you really good ideas of sort of I know I use this word a lot, but it really kind of the workflow of Slackware. This is how you need to think of your computer usage in order to make your computer work harder for you. That's not a bad thing. I would humbly suggest that Slacker Media does this a little bit more explicitly than Slackbook. Slackbook is a great overview of all the tools, of all the concepts in Unix and networking and all that other stuff. Slacker Media really does try, I hope, to hold your hand a little bit more and say, look, here's what you need to investigate. Here's how you can manage packages on Slackware, and so on. So getting Slack, though, would be the first thing you'd need to do at some, you know, to start the journey. You need to be running Slackware. And it's not as scary as it may or may not sound. And it's not really that much hard. It's not really that hard work. It's something that you can do and enjoy and learn a lot from. So getting Slack would be the 0th thing, possibly the first. And then neck and neck with that would be to learn Slack. And that's obviously a really stupid, broad statement, right? I mean, that's why I'm trying to do this how-to. So why am I telling you to learn Slackware? Well, I am not trying to actually teach you Slackware right now in this how-to. I'm just telling you how to be a Slacker. Slackware itself, you should investigate. You should learn. You should learn the tools. You should know about the different Slackware-specific scripts that Pat and the team throws in for you to use. That's part of what I'm talking about. You know, they're making your life easier by simplifying things. And something that would have taken 3 commands, there might be a tool, a little script that they wrote to make it into 1. So these are simple things that you should know about, and they're not out of reach. They're just not going to present themselves to you when you log in. They're not going to say, hey, you should check out these tools. You have to go kind of looking for them, and the place that you look would be, I would say, primarily the Slack book, or Slacker Media, if I may promote my own work. But Slack book first, actually, because it tells you just about the system kind of system level stuff, a lot more so than Slacker Media would. So reading the Slack book and just kind of reading up on Slackware in general, whether it's on the website or the documentation that you install along with Slackware, reading that stuff is really important. I would say that the simile here, or the equivalent of this in the BSD world, is the FreeBSD manual. And there's nobody that can tell me that that's not one of the best things to happen to Unix ever. The FreeBSD manual is a phenomenal document. You thought the Gentoo wiki was good, and it is. Well, it was. The Arch wiki now is very good. But the BSD manual, I mean, it's just right there. You know, it's got everything you need spelled out. Easy to find, easy to get document. You can look at it online. You can download the plain text and or the PDF version of it. It's just, it's a great, great thing. And it's beautiful because it's the authoritative place for your answers and for your questions. You know, and I can't count how many times I've met people who say, hey, I'm running Ubuntu, you know, which is famously the easiest of the Linux distributions. They're running Ubuntu, and they went to go to find out how to install Firefox or upgrade Firefox, and they got five different answers, and they ended up just going to getfirefox.com, downloading the static binary, and just running it off of their hard, you know, out of their home folder. Which, you know, I mean, you can't really argue that that's wrong, but it might not be the best way to ever to do it, you know? So, but the fact that they're getting five different answers for Ubuntu just kind of shows you that having that all-important document that says, this is how you do these things, I think that's really important. It's hugely undervalued, I think, in Linux distributions. I don't really think people understand how important that is. And it's not even necessarily that people are going to read it, right? I mean, we didn't invent the term RTFM for nothing, but it is something that you can therefore always point to when they come and ask for support. Hey, how do I install Firefox? Did you read the manual? If not, go read that. Come back if you have any questions. It's really as simple as that. And I know that that sounds mean, and you know, you might not want to say it exactly like that. You might say, oh, well, there's a great section in the manual here on page whatever. You know, I mean, you can work it however you need to work it so that people don't get frightened off. But the point is that it exists. It's the authoritative answer. And those five answers are essentially negated, or four of those five answers are negated, because you've got the right way of doing it in your manual. So think of the Slack book as that. It's the FreeBSD manual for Slackware. It's got all the information that you really, really need. So that would be the zeroth or the first pillar is to learn Slackware. Now, the third pillar would be reading the changelog. And the changelog is not always active, but it is a place to be aware of. This is, in many ways, how you know what's going on with Slackware. And it took me a long time to find the changelog. I didn't understand the importance or the significance of the changelog early on. But once you do start reading it, I mean, I have my web browsers, almost all of them, they're, you know, the starting page or whatever goes straight to the changelog. That's just where they start. So I see the latest news at the top of my browser every time I launch a browser. And it's great. It's a great resource to have. It's, again, it's not always groundbreaking stuff. Sometimes it's, I updated glibc in the current directory today. Big deal. I'm not running current, and I don't even know what glibc is, so I don't care. But sometimes it's really good. Like, I added security patches for Firefox and Thunderbird and SeaMonkey today. And then I could do a Slack package update of Mozilla dash everything. So it's something to keep an eye on because it keeps your finger on the pulse of the operating system that you run. So you're not going to get little pop-ups in Slackware that say, you must upgrade your Firefox today. Would you like me to do that for you? Would you like me to tie up your package management system while I update stuff out from under you? That doesn't happen. So you kind of want to educate yourself on that. And honestly, the easiest way, at least for me, is for my browser to just pop up with the changelog every time I open a browser. That might not work for you. You might prefer to get it in some other form. You might want to, script something to download it and send it to an RSS reader of some sort. I don't know what you want to do. Point is, you should look at it if you're going to be a Slackware user. And the changelog, you can find that on slackware.com. Just look over on the left for the changelogs. So the fourth pillar, would be get familiar with Slack builds. Slack builds, I've obviously talked about them on this show. I'm not going to go into detail on them now, but they are important. They're the easy way to install software on Slackware. A lot of people, kind of get the impression that Slackware is all from source and has to be done from source and stuff like that. And what they end up doing, is make, .configure make install, which is fine. That works. The danger there is, of course, that then upgrading, unmaking all that stuff or make uninstalling that stuff gets a little bit dodgy. Whereas if you do it as a package, then it's super simple. It's really simple. So you do kind of want to learn about the packaging system. I'm not saying you have to make your own. Of course, slackbuilds.org exists. You can download, they're just shell scripts that very expertly helps you build something from source code as a package and then to install it as a package. So you have a record of when and how and what you installed, and you've got an easy way to then uninstall that package and all the files that are directly related to that package. It's a really brilliant system, and slackbuilds.org is the big official place for that, but I think a lot of people don't realize that there are other places for Slack builds, and this is kind of what I mean by Slackware being fairly decentralized. I mean, it might be kind of funny to call Slackware not centralized because the maintainer, there's one primary maintainer of the distribution, Pat Volkerding, and so you think of it as kind of a very, not top-heavy distribution. It's like it's got that one person at the pinnacle who manages everything and kind of owns everything. And, while that's true, and yes, he would obviously be the lead maintainer of the project, it doesn't mean that everything comes down from that one point. So Slack builds can exist all over the place, and as you start getting familiar with the community and start making friends who also use Slackware, you can start trading back and forth Slack builds. Now you can submit it to a somewhat centralized place like slackbuilds.org, which, that's not really centralized. I mean, it is centralized, but it's not from Pat. It's a community thing. It's something that other people have built and other people contribute to, but not everyone does. And so you can find friends who run Slackware, and you can go to their web pages and download all kinds of cool Slack builds. And you can look through those Slack builds to make sure your friend isn't screwing you over with bad code. But yes, you can do that, and it becomes very simple. So I guess this is kind of a deceptive thing. You think, Slackware doesn't have a repository with 100,000 different packages in it ready to be installed. Well, it might not, but it's got Slack builds, and they're all over the place. There's some that are centralized. There are some with very reliable people who have written them and will let you download them if you want them. You can actually build your own. They're really easy to make, generally speaking. So it's deceptive. You don't have a big monolithic app store, but you've got a plethora of potential apps out there that you can download and compile and install. Or you don't need to install, you don't need to compile to install. Sometimes you can download the binary distributions of things for Slackware, believe it or not. Yes, you can. There are a couple of people online who are who famously build these things and post them. One of them, I guess, is, I think it's Slacky or Slackware.it, something like that. I've never actually used this site. I just keep hearing about it, and a lot of people do use it. I've just never really felt the need to, but I'm pretty sure that they have like binary builds of a lot of different packages, by which I mean, oh, sorry, this is the fifth pillar. Get familiar with Slackware packages. So binary, by which I mean they're not Slack builds. They're not a shell script where you download the shell script and then you download the source code and then you compile and install. They're actually just, they're something that someone else has built. You know, the compiling of the software has happened on someone else's computer, and then they package everything up, the executable program and everything, all the config files. They package it up into a Slack package, and then you can download that. It's obviously a bigger download. It's, you know, as big as the application is, 45, 23, 13 megs, whatever it might be, and then you install it. You just issue install PKG, and it distributes all those files throughout your computer where they're supposed to go. So this is a lot like doing like a yum install so-and-so or an aptitude install foo. It's the same thing. You're not compiling anything ever. It's just downloading the package that has already been very generically compiled and then installed onto your system. And for the record, that's actually kind of what I do for myself, since I have a very nice and powerful computer at my job. I can compile stuff all day long if I want to, package them up into little Slack packages, and then send those Slackware packages over to my laptop for installation on there, and it happens a lot faster because my laptop is not the most powerful thing in the world at all. So that's been kind of nice, actually, to be able to do that. It's not even really cross-compiling. You're just compiling it. You're just saying, here's a 64-bit Intel machine. Here's a 64 Intel machine. I'll just compile over here since this one has 8 cores and this one has 2, and that'll be a lot better for me. And it is. It's a lot faster. So Slack packages are very, very nice, and getting used to the idea that you might not necessarily have to even let a shell script compile stuff for you. You can just download the thing that's already been compiled with maybe in some cases like VLC, which famously has, you know, 20 and 30 different libraries that it needs to depend on. Forget that. Just download the binary package from Alien Bob's website and install it. It takes all of 5 seconds, and then you're up and running with VLC all of a sudden. 2.0, 2.1, whatever it is. 2.0.1. So yeah, Slack packages exist. That was, what are we on, the fifth pillar now? Sixth pillar of Slackness is to build your own Slack build packages. This sounds like a crazy idea. It always kind of seemed really cool. It still seems really cool to me, actually. The fact that I was able to actually build my own Slack build packages. Now I kind of build Slack build and RPMs, you know. I mean, not super complex ones, but it's kind of a normal-ish thing for me to do. But I mean, at one point, building Slack packages or Slack builds, it just seemed like I'd cracked some kind of ancient code. It was just so cool, and it is really actually cool. You have no idea how relatively simple it is. Again, Slackware is not a lot of work. Slack builds, there are templates. There are not just one template, not just two templates. There's a template for CMake, there's a template for Make, for Perl, for Python, for Ruby, all kinds of different things. You can download this template for a Slack build, look through it. It's a shell script. It's bash. You know a little bit of bash. You know how to do a Slack build. Most of it's done for you, to be honest. I mean, in some cases, quite literally, all a rough and tumble Slack build would take is to plug in the name and the version number of the application that you want to build, the source code that you want to build. You grab the source code from online, you run the script, and it's done. I mean, that's all there is to it in some cases. It depends on the software. It's just not that hard. It's the fanciest thing that happens in a Slack build is that it compiles everything into a destination directory that isn't the real destination. That's the fancy mojo of it all. And then it runs make pkg, which runs a script to package it all up into something that can then be easily distributed throughout the file system. It's really a lot of basic kind of normal Unixy things like, okay, what architecture are we building for? Is it 32 or is it 64-bit? What kind of make flags do we want to issue, if any? Where does the documentation go? You know, different little things like this. It's not that big of a deal. And the templates exist, so you can kind of reverse engineer anything that you don't quite understand. Building them for yourself is a very, very powerful thing to do, because if they don't exist, then not only are you able to now build a package from source in a very easily upgradable, removable, trackable, whatever method, but you could even submit it to, for instance, slackbuilds.org, or share it with friends so that they too can build stuff from source on their Slackware system. And I can't emphasize enough how easy it is. If you've ever, and everyone says this, but if you ever used ports on BSD, if you've ever even played around with BSD long enough to try one port, it's basically the same idea. You know, it's just like, you grab the source, you run a shell script, and the rest takes care of itself. And that's easy. That's easy. Learning a whole new database front end to manage packages and all of their dependencies, that to me is not easy. I'm not saying it's bad. I'm just saying it's not the pinnacle of easiness. So that's the, I don't know, whatever pillar we're on now. I'm tired of the pillar analogy. So then the next thing is to join in with the community. I think I lied, too. I said 8 pillars. There are actually only 7. The next thing is to join the community. So the Slackware community is a little bit, I don't know, maybe a little bit weird, because you go to slackware.com and you don't see a big welcoming wiki that says, get involved. Here's the community. Here's the ambassador program, or the, what do they call them on Ubuntu? The, I don't know, the locos, whatever they're called. You know, the, what is it called? The diplomats, the Ubuntu diplomats. Here's the diplomat team or whatever, and the ambassador team. And sign up for our forum and post your questions. And, you know, there's not that going on there. So getting involved with the community is kind of, I guess, always a question of, well, where is this community again? And of course, it's up to you as to where the community is. I know of, I'd say, 3 or 4 or 5 different communities of Slackware users. I mean, one would, the obvious one, I guess, or maybe not obvious, but one would be the IRC community. If you get onto freenode.net and go into the #/ Slackware channel, that's where a lot of Slackware users hang out, so you could get involved with the community that way. Ogcast Planet in the same place on IRC, freenode.net. A lot of Slackware users there as well, so you could get involved in that smaller community. LinuxQuestions.org, obviously, it's a hugely famous community in general, but if you hang around in the Slackware question forums, then you start to get to know people there as well. What else? Oh yeah, mailing lists. Mailing lists are big, you know. I mean, there's a Slack builds mailing list. There's a Slackware security mailing list. There's a Slack something. I guess that's it. There's two mailing lists. In all of Slackware, there's two. That's probably a lot more, but those are the two that come to mind. But if you're looking for people who run Slackware and who can maybe give you some guidance on things that you don't know how to do yet, maybe you've heard about some cool trick that you want to try but you just don't know how to yet or whatever, and you need guidance on that, the Slackware community would be the place to go to sort of learn more about those things. I mean, there's always the expectation that you have done some research. I mean, I don't think anyone in any distribution in any channel likes it when people sign in and say, okay, I want to sniff Wi-Fi traffic. How do I do it? You know, I mean, you shouldn't be asking that. You should be asking, I've got this card. From what I've read, I need to put it into monitor mode with this command. I do that, and I don't know if it's working. How can I check? You know, whatever. There's that expectation, but I think that's consistent in many, many different places, and it's almost the exception where it's not the expectation. And in the long run, I don't know how well it goes when you don't have that expectation. You know, when you tell people, hey, don't worry about it, just come in and ask any question, we'll step you through every single thing. That gets messy after a while, especially once you start to realize that the people asking the questions don't ever intend to read up on the topic that they're asking about. They're just going to never learn anything. They just want someone to do stuff for them, and then they'll just keep living their computer life that way. And that's wrong. Yes, I just pronounced that wrong. Like, on a moral and ethic level, that's just wrong. So there you go. So Slackware's got a little bit of that going on. They do expect you to, I think the community generally expects you to read up, to have some starting point from which you can ask the question. But I think that's reasonable. So the community's important for that reason. And last but not least, and maybe this shouldn't even be the last, I don't know, but and so I guess there are eight pillars after all. Well, we'll review them in a minute and get a final count. It's to be okay with stability. Stability is this great, big, powerful word that people really like. People like to hear stable, and they pride themselves on stability, and they want stability. People seek after stability. And yet there's like this weird negative connotation behind the word stability that people, I think, almost aren't aware of, but they do think it. And stability also often suggests old and outdated and boring and things like that. I can tell you officially that stable does not mean old or outdated or boring. It simply means stable. And with Slackware, I think to get the most mileage out of Slackware, you need to be okay with stability. And honestly, it doesn't take that long for you to become okay with stability after you've had it for a while. It starts to become very addicting. Especially when you're really, really doing stuff on your computer. When you're really relying on this box to run consistently and reliably every day for a year, 2 years, whatever, you start to really appreciate stability. I think that the Linux community, part of the reason that we get into Linux is because we like to play with computers. And part of that translates into trying new stuff with your computer. And in Linux, part of that translates into trying out new software, updating stuff, getting the latest code, trying it out, see what breaks, that kind of thing. And there's nothing wrong with that. But I think that in order to build a computing environment for yourself that is, I guess, serious, or what I would consider serious, you have to either redirect that focus and say, okay, I want to play on my computer and I want to try new stuff and I want to do cool things. For me personally, I think that sometimes the really easy way to do that is to just go to my Fedora box and try a bunch of weird stuff that I would never try on my normal computer, on the computer that I use every day. You know, I'll install wacky applications that I would never try anywhere else. I'll update to kernels that make a grown man cry. You know, it's just, you're crazy on these cutting edge distributions. And that's great. That's a lot of fun. I think sometimes, however, I try to step away from the Fedora box, and I sit down at the Slackware box, at the stable computer, and I do stuff that in the end is just as crazy, but it's a lot more focused. So things like, okay, I'm going to write a program today, and instead of doing it in Bash, which I feel like I know well enough to kind of sit down and just play around in, I'm going to do it in Python. And that's crazy. I mean, that's nuts for me. That's a daring, wild night on the town kind of thing. You working in Python, you don't know what you're doing. You got 20 tabs open trying to figure out what Python module gives you what control over something in a class and functions and other programming terms. You know, and it's really exciting. It feels different, but it's just as daring and out of control. But it's still kind of within that stable ecosphere where you're not breaking anything. You're just screwing up a lot and writing bad programs. But that's great because you're learning. So for me, the stability kind of gives me that kind of focus. I'm not saying I don't love to mess around on Fedora. I mean, that's great. But I am saying that there's another side of that sort of reckless, oh, I want to go in and get my hands dirty. You can do that on a stable platform. You just have to do it differently than maybe what we've kind of trained ourselves to do in Linux because we were noobs and we were being haphazard and installing everything, and that was playing on Linux. Well, at some point you can shift that focus, if needed, to something that you want to learn, you know, about your operating system or learning more about Linux in general, you know. Firing up a VM and doing a Linux from scratch, you know, whatever. Weird things like that don't have to involve breaking your primary system. I'm not saying there's a right or a wrong way to do it or that everyone should do this thing that I do. I'm just saying that as Linux users, I think that we all have those kind of two personalities, the mild-mannered, stability-loving Linux user and the crazy, deviant, cutting-edge Fedora user, or whatever your cutting-edge distro of choice might be. More broadly speaking, I think that Linux, you know, in a worldwide kind of setting, I think Linux needs to be okay with stability anyway, because I really think, and I've said this for a very long time, I think that distributions that release, you know, once every 6 months or whatever it is, I think that's insane, especially to gear that distribution to the general public. I think that's a dangerous thing to do. I don't think that there's anything wrong with it. I just think that it's a dangerous precedence because you're setting people up with this new operating system, and then you're pushing out these very hyperbolic updates every six, or really upgrades every 6 months, seems a little bit nutty. Whereas if you really made a bigger deal about those big stable releases, that might be a lot smarter, I guess. Which, in a sense, is why, like, Red Hat not being a consumer desktop is, to me, a little bit crazy. I see the model that they kind of have, where Red Hat gets all the benefits of those crazy experiments that Fedora does. That seems like a brilliant scheme to me, you know? Have two different brands. There's the Red Hat stable one, and there's the Fedora wonky crazy one. If Ubuntu did something like that, maybe I'd find it easier to stomach their six-month release cycle. Have a brand that says, yes, you can use me, general consumer, and then have all the serious Linux geeks using this other thing that's really, really, very, 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 very similar, like basically the same thing except with a different branding, but, you know, the set piece, the thing that you put on the shelf, is the very stable thing, because that's what people are used to. How long have people been using Windows XP forever? Some people in this world don't even remember that there was anything before Windows XP. You know, that that is Windows to them, or it was until Vista and 7 and 8 and all these other things came out. But yeah, point being, the world really does like stable. They really do. And I know that Linux, as an operating system, we've always got to do a little bit of catch-up because the new hardware is coming out and they're not exactly working with us to let us know what's happening, so the developers are always going to be just one half of a step, maybe one step behind the manufacturers, which, of course, is a problem that none of us can really control right now, but yeah, it's a problem. But stability is my point, and stability is a good thing, and you should be okay with it. And if you can harness your desire to do crazy things with your computer towards learning your system rather than just haphazardly randomly installing new applications, it might be a good way to focus in on learning Slackware, for instance, and getting really good at maintaining the computer that you use on an everyday basis. So these are all my ideas of how to become a Slackware user. They're not representative, really, of anything or anyone, probably other than me, but that's kind of like, there are a lot of things in there that other Slackware users, I think, kind of agree with and do themselves. So, reviewing quickly, the zeroth point, I think, was to go get Slackware, to install it. The first was to learn Slackware. The third was to read the changelog, and that is on slackware.com. You can find the changelog link over on the left. The fourth was to get familiar with Slack builds, to use them, to learn how to use Slack builds, to get to love them. The fifth was to get familiar with Slackware packages that are offered by reliable sources that you will know from getting to know the community online. So Slackware packages are the pre-built binaries. You can install them, download and install them in a matter of seconds, usually. The sixth was to learn how to build Slackware, Slack build scripts, to build your own Slackware packages, essentially. And then the seventh, oh, there were only seven. Well, I probably missed one. The seventh was to, nope, that's the seventh, was to join the community. Yep, we're on the home stretch now. And then the eighth was to be okay with stability. And all of those arguments are all those points are arguable. I'm sure some Slackware users like stability. That's for losers, and they run Slackware Current, and they're really cool, and I admire those people. I've been there, but I'm more of a stable person now. So there you go. That's how to become a Slacker. If you're confused about kind of like the culture of Slackware or whatever, that's the intro right there. Get it, learn it, become familiar with the package management, read the change log, and just kind of hang out in places where other Slackware users might appear and kind of get a feel for what they are doing and what they're aware of and any kind of new news that might be coming down the pipe. For instance, did you know that Slackware 14 was probably pretty close because the version number was changed in the current tree? Yeah, you wouldn't know that, but you would if you'd read the changelog. So, there you go. So, hopefully this has helped. If anyone has had questions on kind of like how to get into that whole Slackware world, I think that's it. That's the Slackware world. There's no big wiki. You can't sign up to be a Slackware ambassador or a Slackware diplomat or whatever you're calling yourself. You just sort of come in, you start using it, you get familiar with the tools, and suddenly you just find yourself kind of being a Slacker. It's easy, right? It's a lot easier than all the red tape that you have to go through with all those other distributions. Slackware.com and Slacker Media. And that's about all for the show today, I think. So next episode's going to be the season finale. Be sure to join me for that. Until then, I am Klaatu. You can find me in IRC as Not Klaatu, in Ogcast Planet and Slackware. That's on irc.freenode.net. You can also find me online at GNUWorldOrder.info. You can email me, klaatu@member.fsf.org. And you can jabber me at notklaatu@jabber.org. Thanks for listening. Talk to you next time.